Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, Frederick Harris is joining us. Frederick is the author of The Price of the Ticket, Barack Obama and the Rise and Decline of Black Politics. He is a professor of political science and director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University and is one of America's leading scholars of race and politics. He's also the author of Something Within and Countervailing Forces in African American Civilization, The Price of the Ticket, Barack Obama, and the Rise and Decline of Black Politics is our conversation this hour. He looks at a number of issues. He sort of frames the hour, and then I want us to hear a little bit of Barack Obama's speech back in 2007. With the election of Barack Obama as the 44th president of the United States, Frederick Harris writes, one could easily draw the conclusion that Black America reached the pinnacle of political empowerment, a journey that's taken Blacks from one of the most marginalized groups in American history to a key constituency that helps elect a man of African descent to lead the nation. But the economic conditions of the nation that greeted him after he was inaugurated and the race neutral political rhetoric that helped catapult him into the White House put the significance of his election for Black America in doubt. Far from Black America gaining greater influence in American politics, Obama's ascendancy to the White House actually signals a decline of a politics aimed at challenging racial inequality head-on. Frederick Harris looks at a number of other Black politicians, Shirley Chisholm, Jesse Jackson, a number of other politicians, and looks at different ways of gaining election, how they speak to minorities in this country. It's a fascinating, fascinating book. And Frederick Harris, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for the wonderful introduction.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I wanted to start, if you don't mind, with President Barack Obama, and because I think if we start at this point, we can go back in history. But you, and we have part of this speech, in the wink, nod, vote part of your book, you talk about President Obama giving a speech on June 5 in 2007. And when I listened to that speech today, I thought, oh, my gosh, this is a whole different Barack Obama, but I wanted to hear some of this, and then we'll talk about where he was and why he is where he is now. But if you could set it up for us, because I know he starts the speech with talk about the miracle baby standing as a parable for the plight of the Black poor. We pick it up when he talks about getting the bullet out, just so we reference. Could you please tell us what he's talking about, the pregnant woman shot on her way to the grocery store?
Yeah, he's telling an interesting story about an incident during the L.A. riots in the early 90s. And he tells the story of this miracle baby. The woman is shot during the riots, and the baby is in the stomach of the mother is also affected. And there's a bullet lodged near the arm of the child. The candidate, Barack Obama, uses this as a metaphor to talk about the scar of racial inequality or racism within American society. And it's up to people, it's up to government, it's up to those who are committed to challenging racial inequality to take the bullet out. Mm. And he goes on and talk about, you know, what the bullets are that are still lodged within the womb of Black America.
Thank you. It's a nice setup. So here is President Obama, then candidate Obama, June 5, 2007, a speech at the annual conference of ministers at Hampton University.
And so God is asking us today to remember the miracle of that baby, and he's asking us, he says, take the bullet out. If we have more Black men in prison than in our colleges and universities, then it's time to take the bullet out. If we had millions of people going to the emergency room for treatable illnesses like asthma, it's time to take the bullet out. If too many of our kids don't have health insurance, it's time to take that bullet out. If we keep sending our kids to crumbling school buildings, if we keep fighting this war in Iraq, a war that should have never been authorized and should have never been waged, a war that's costing us $275 million a day that could have been invested in rebuilding communities all across this country. It is time to take that bullet out.
Frederick Harris, when have you heard the president speak like that since that time? Does he address those issues in his presidency?
No, he doesn't. Every time I hear that speech, it sort of reminds me of sort of the disappearance of that Barack Obama. He spoke passionately like that again on numerous occasions in 2007. But you have to put that Barack Obama in context of what was happening at the time. And this is the part of the argument of the book is that he desperately needed the support of black voters,
right,
in order to make his campaign competitive. And this is the Barack Obama before the candidate won in Iowa in January in 2008. And so we sort of forget this Barack Obama. He didn't talk about race that much, but when he did go before black audiences, when he was trailing Hillary Clinton among black voters, and in the case of September 2007, where he gave another passionate speech at Howard University, a major speech indeed on criminal justice, he was pressured to do this because of the competition for the black vote, and also there were advocates in black communities who were pressuring the candidate to speak out on criminal justice issues at that time.
Hmm. You asked this question, and I'm going to ask it of you, even though we probably need years to answer. You say one day the question will be asked, years if not decades from now, whether the sacrifices of previous generations were worth the rise of a race-neutral black presidency whose ascendancy was made possible by their efforts.
Yes, that's the concluding paragraph of the book. And I have to say, I want to go back to the beginning of the book to place context to what I meant to that.
Mm-hmm.
James Baldwin is partly the inspiration for the arguments of this book. James Baldwin wasn't a political scientist he was a writer. And he wrote a put together a collection of essays called The Price of the Ticket. And Baldwin, throughout his career, never let up about the importance of raising the issues of racial inequality in this country. And so the question that's brought forth, being motivated by Baldwin, is what is the price of the election of a person of African descent in this country? And I would venture the price is silence around issues regarding racial inequality. And so that concluding paragraph sort of raises this question, what is the price? Because the book is part history and politics and part politics. And so the question is that I go through what those sacrifices are with the travails of Shirley Chisholm and Jesse Jackson in the 70s and 80s. And there are other events that happened that I didn't detail in the book. But here you have the tensions between the symbolism of the election of a black president and the substantive consequences of not addressing issues of racial inequality. And so I suspect, paying attention to what Baldwin wrote, where I talk about the tensions between history and the memory, and memory is the struggle of community memory about what the sacrifices were, and the national memory of the meaning of a black man being president of the United States, and this clash between memory and history, and national history rather, is what I think is very troubling when we look at the price that's being paid in silence.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that symbolism is just it's a very powerful thing just in itself without looking at the issues right now. But the symbolism of seeing him as president of the United States that made so many people weep for such a long time on that election night, including Jesse Jackson, who was doing a different kind of politics, sometimes it kind of stops you in the track. Am I overstating what that symbolism is and how important it is to have that symbol? You need both, perhaps, but you've got a symbol that's a big thing, just like you've got a Martin Luther King symbol now in a monument in Washington, D.C.
Right. I mean, I don't want to underestimate at all the importance, the impact on history that the election of Barack Obama has had for the United States, for the African-American community, for other communities of color, for other communities that have struggled for dignity. But I think we need to make a separation between what many political theorists have written about called the politics of recognition and the substantive importance of communities that have been historically and in some cases continue to be left out. The question becomes, you know, what does it mean for a powerful symbol to exist if it really, in some ways, legitimized the existence of the persistence of racial inequality in this country. So that is to say that even with the election of Barack Obama, we hear the calls for no more excuses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Black Americans across the board, no matter what their station in life, no matter what communities they rise up from, have no excuses when it comes to the possibilities of making it in this country. I suggest that I don't subscribe to that. I think there are deep, persistent inequalities, racial inequalities, class inequalities that exist within American society. And the idea that the election of African Americans can sort of pave over these legacies.
Mm-hmm.
This persistence, I think, is troubling.
Hmm. So let's look at the early parts of the book, looks at the history of black voters either organizing into a cohesive independent bloc and others urging a more race-neutral approach. Who do we associate with that cohesive independent bloc movement, and does it even still exist, Professor?
Right, that's a very good question. As I talk about in the book, there was a clash of ideas, as I explain it, that developed in the mid-1960s. On the one hand, there was the civil rights activist, Lieutenant Byatt Rustin, who worked with Dr. King, who wrote this very influential essay, From Protest to Politics, where he really staked out, just prior to the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, what black voters should be doing. And he talked about the importance of building coalitions. He talked about, in many ways, the importance of universal policies that affect everyone. And he thought that this should be done with a coalition of people in labor, sympathetic, supportive whites, religious, liberal-leaning religious communities that would really be a part of the Democratic Party, basically an extension or a development or growth of the New Deal coalition that developed in the 1930s. On the other hand, on the other side, rather, was Malcolm X. And Malcolm X, who was transitioning from the Nation of Islam, becoming much more independent, becoming much more engaged in the importance of black Americans having a stake within the political system, it gave a speech called "The a Ballot or the Bullet."
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the importance of community-driven interest. That no matter what the politician, black or white, there were community interests that were permanent, and that black Americans should not give their votes to any politician who they didn't think were addressing their issues. And so, you know, there's been this back and forth from the sort of coalition universalist school to the independent black politics school. You know, in 72, it was interesting, Shirley Chisholm actually was in between the sort of coalition independent black politics perspective. She, as I show remind people at the beginning that Shirley Chisholm didn't see herself as the candidate of Black America, the candidate of women. She was a candidate of Americans. You know, this phrase would echo decades later with Barack Obama.
Right. Yes.
But when she tried to leverage whatever influence she had at the Miami convention, she went to the black delegates because feminists were not they were supportive symbolically but not practically, and so she used the independent black perspective to try to corral black delegates in order to put together an agenda that the Democratic Party candidate would address. And, of course, Jesse Jackson in the 80s, you know, it was much more independent focused in 1984. It's Our Time Now, mm-hmm. was the for the campaign slogan. And the Rainbow Coalition in 1988, which he did very well among white voters in a relative sense. He got 20% of the white vote, which was quite astounding for Jesse Jackson, given his history. And so there's been this sort of, again, this tension between coalition building and independent black politics. But what's interesting about the coalition wing of black politics is that you begin to have black politicians who begin to use a race-neutral campaign strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I would argue, would help to derail the ability of black voters to put their issues on the electoral agenda.
And David Axelrod was the mastermind of that for Obama?
No, he was a part of it, although he had practiced for quite a while. He gained his reputation partly by assisting black mayors in getting elected in situations where they needed white voters in order to win in campaigns in Cleveland, in Detroit of all places, because it's a majority black city, but also in Philadelphia. But he actually started, I think it's one of his first campaigns was in 1987 when Harold Washington was running for re-election.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right, and Axelrod was a reporter. I'm not sure which Chicago newspaper it I forget at the moment. I think it was the Chicago Sun-Times. I'm not sure. But he became a political operative. He did press media work for Harold Washington. And there's an interesting story in the book where Axelrod is all happy because Harold Washington got 20% of the white vote. It wasn't a majority, even though Harold Washington was the Democratic nominee and there was a independent white candidate. Harold Washington, you know, I can't use the language over the radio, but he
thank
said,
you.
isn't it to be a black man in America? And so even with the support, even when Harold Washington was campaigning 80 or 90% in white communities, majority white communities in Chicago, he only got 20% of the vote. But the point is that Axelrod cut his teeth in sort of building support for minority or black candidates among white voters. And it started decades ago before he met.
And Washington used this strategy and was reelected on the strategy of a cohesive independent bloc?
Because the coalition that developed, which is basically part of the independent black politics perspective,
mm-hmm.
he won mostly because of high black turnout and Latino voters and few white voters, along the Chicago's Lake Front. Liberal white. It was highly cohesive, highly cohesive.
Mm-hmm.
And so among black voters. And you have to remember, he basically only squeaked by.
We are going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Our Phone number is 800-486-8655. Frederick Harris is professor of political science and director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University, one of the leading scholars in this country of race and politics, author of another book as well. And it's a fascinating book because it looks at the issues that many people are concerned about that deal with racial issues. There are many of them, the high incarceration rate, the terrible schools, the HIV rates, there are class issues and race issues that still permeate American society. But this particular president has a race-neutral universalism aspect, which is how it got him elected and how he is governing. You heard at the top of the show that really dramatic speech that showed the difference when he pays attention to issues of race, which he hasn't done much of it. So why is that the case, and what are the two camps that have gone different directions when it comes to blacks in politics? 800-486-8655 is the number. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. He mentions Shirley Chisholm, and just because it's been a while since we've all heard Shirley Chisholm, we wanted to play her a little bit. He writes about her extensively in the book as the first black woman elected to Congress. This is during her 1972 campaign for president.
The hour has come in America that all of us in this room can no longer be the passive recipients of whatever the politics of a nation may decree for us as citizens within this realm. But if we have the courage of our convictions, if we desire to make a contribution, to make this nation bring about the fulfillment of the American dream so that it is meaningful to every segment in America, we will forget what the world will say, whether we are in our place or out of our place.
We welcome phone calls for Frederick Harris. His book is The Price of the Ticket, Barack Obama and the Rise and Decline of Black Politics. Rich and Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I don't want to get us too far afield, and I'm sure Kathleen can tell you guests that anytime I say that, it's sort of like, oh, watch out. I've been dipping back in history and reading fictionalized and unfiction accounts of Nat Turner and of John Brown in particular. Just finished a very evocative book about John Brown, Raising Holy Hell by Bruce Auld.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if the guest sees this kind of politics that's going on in our country right now. It seems to me it's just more of the same old separate but equal kind of concept that we deceive ourselves with. And the author Bruce Auld, at the beginning of a chapter, quotes, you know, from facts of our forefathers and quotes George Washington saying, "I shall frankly declare I do not like even to think, much less to talk of slavery." But Barack Obama says in one of his books he didn't see any advantage or any power in being the angry black man. Well, he's black, and I see him, at least by our definition, he's half black, half white. He's not angry enough for me. He seems as though it's sort of like that speech about get the bullet out is part of his very effective rhetoric to mobilize voters. But I don't, this presidency I was hoping would draw us more together as an American people. And if anything, it seems as though people have figured out to use his presidency as a wedge to drive us farther apart. And it's a kind of separate but equal sort of thing. I know I'm not being very clear.
No, I think you're being very...
And listen on air, but
thank you. I think those were some perceptive comments. Frederick Harris.
Yeah, well, you have to keep in mind that when there's any progress in this country, progress particularly regarding race, that there's going to be some pushback or backlash. And so even though, you know, there are many who think that the president hasn't been vocal enough around racial inequality or the persistence of it, nonetheless, as a black man who holds the most powerful position in the country, there are a lot of people who are upset about that, even as much as he tapped down or downplays race. And so, you know, one cannot expect Barack Obama to be a Nat Turner or John Brown within the White House. You know, he couldn't get elected. He's barely able to govern as it is now. But nonetheless, I think the way that I like to look at this is that for people who are interested in the issue of challenging racial inequality in this country, we have to be reminded that those interests are permanent, no matter who's in the White House. So even though, you know, his handlers and often the president may say that I'm a president who just happens to be black, I would argue that African-American voters are the most loyal constituency within the Democratic Party. No other constituency gives 90% or more of its votes to the Democratic Party. This constituency, this loyal constituency also happens to be black and needs issues that need to be attended to. Hmm. And so why I am sympathetic to Rich's questions about division, nonetheless, I think we could never, one should never give up on these issues regarding racial inequality.
Frederick Harris, do you think, I've heard this said by Robert Reich and others, that when you listen to Obama, as we did at the beginning of the hour, and hear him address with what seems to be like genuine passion for all of those issues, that there was so much to deal with just being the first black president in this country and all the issues of race that are still so much a part of American society, that the fact that he has not dealt with the persistence of racial inequality the first 4 years was something he could not do because he didn't want to divide the country along racial lines, and so he's waiting until the next 4 years to deal with some of those issues that he outlined, or is that just what some people are hopeful he'll do?
Well, in the book I refer to this as moving the goalpost argument, because this is the same rationalization we heard during the campaign that, you know, particularly after Al, when he sort of had black voters locked in, and particularly after South Carolina primary. And so what people say, well, you know, he can't really talk about race. Just wait till he gets elected. So the goalpost is being moved.
Right.
And then people said, well, you know, he can't do much now. There's this economic crisis. Wait until the midterm. Well, we know what happened in the midterm. Now we're being asked to wait until the second term, if there is a second term. And so, you know, there are issues that are still on the table that are very urgent. I understand the complexity of all this. I'm not naive in any way. But I think that the difference between particularly black voters and other constituencies, I talk about this in the book, particularly the gay and lesbian community.
Yes, yes.
And particularly, you know, even some gradual successes around immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is that those constituencies kept pushing the president to do something.
Oh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And so in the case of African-American voters, or in also those who are sympathetic to issues around racial inequality who are not African-American, there's a tendency to protect and not pressure. And as a consequence, we get very little action on these issues because people don't want to raise the issues because it may be given as fodder by the right wing.
Hmm. Is anybody pressuring? Can you think of any leaders pressuring, particularly African American leaders?
No, the people are pretty quiet. I call it the closed ranks mentality. I think The NAACP has been very reluctant to support the president. Activists like Al Sharpton, who always raised these issues, even under the Clinton administration, is now a presidential advisor, it seems. And so I think there's this, again, this tendency to protect. There are very few voices of dissent around these issues of challenging the president on issues of racial inequality, mostly because they're trying to protect him from the white right wing. And then there's hope in the second administration, is if there is one, that there would be far more flexibility in what the president can do.
Do you see the same kind of protection surrounding Clarence Thomas?
No, Clarence Thomas is a different political animal. He has a lifetime appointment, but as I document in the book, the same sort of wink and nod agreement. You know, these politicians wink at black voters, and black voters nod back. You know, we know you can't talk about race, or we know that you're talking in a certain way because you have to convince, you know, the white majority that you're going to be okay, you know, around issues of racial inequality. And so one of the most astounding things, if as I document in the book, is to go back to see what black supporters of Clarence Thomas said about his nomination. Maya Angelou, of all people, the great poet, wrote a very supportive endorsement of Clarence Thomas, an op-ed piece in the New York Times, saying that a black person who experienced racial discrimination in the South can't really be that conservative. And perhaps, you know, once he get in, that it'll be a different situation, and that African Americans must, you know, rely on the ancestors' wisdom in order to support or figure out why they should support Clarence Thomas. As I say in the book, the ancestors' wisdom on that question still disappoints. Because Clarence Thomas is on these issues, these substantive issues around civil rights, affirmative action, criminal justice, is one of the most, if not most, conservative justices on these issues. And so in this case, even though by any stretch of the imagination, President Barack Obama is not Clarence Thomas, the mechanisms, the wink and nod, the those dynamics still operate. And it only points to, again, the importance of having a clear agenda and pushing for the agenda no matter what the race, the color, the background of the candidate.
Fascinating. I'm imagining as you were talking, the two of them going out to lunch together. I can't imagine what kind of conversation would ensue.
Well, I would love to be a fly on the wall to see that.
I would too. Rich, thanks for the call. Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, Nick. How are you?
Thanks so much for the show, Kathleen. And guest is amazing. I just recently graduated from school, and I started studying things on my own that I was actually interested in. I studied philosophy in college, and I think philosophy teaches you to learn, or taught me that I can learn anything, basically. It opens my mind. And I just almost finished a book by James Cone, Martin and Malcolm and America, and it's totally opened up my eyes to, it's just completely blown me away. And I guess I don't really know what I wanted to say. I just wanted to, I guess, ask if maybe, you know, a character, do we need, how important was Malcolm, civil rights? Because it seems like he was, you know, the antagonist, and he always was pushing Martin to, you know, I don't know, press issues. Do we need another character like Malcolm, and can we even get one in this society now? I mean, I guess that's what I wanted to know.
All right, thank you.
You know, thank you. You know, I got chills when he mentioned the title of James Cone's book on Malcolm and Martin. It is an extraordinary book. It's a different take, I think a long-neglected take, and this book has been out for a while, that Martin King and Malcolm X in the latter years of their lives were more similar than they were different.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The only difference is that King never gave up on nonviolence. Malcolm X never gave up on self-defense of the black community. But they had a radical democratic vision of the country, particularly Malcolm X, because we think of Malcolm as the, you know, the radical guy who's part of the Nation of Islam sect. But he left the Nation of Islam. He wanted to develop bringing sympathetic whites within his political organization. He talked about racial inequality policy. He wanted to bring the injustices of African Americans to the world court, right? And in those, and so we also see similarities in King's life, which I talk about actually in my book. Mm-hmm. Is that you know, King is moving toward looking at questioning the basis of capitalism. What King is also talking about is on the international stage. He's opposing the Vietnam War. He's also flirting with issues that we would describe today as affirmative action, in the sense of how is it that you would expect people who have been disadvantaged for so long to sort of now in this new domain of rights that have been given by from the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, that there's nothing economically that could be done, or something to ensure that the race, the opportunity that everyone has a fair opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't they far different. Although Malcolm X died in 1964 and King in 1968, by the end part of their lives, they are more similar than they are different.
I'm thinking, I was reading the King chapter, your thoughts about him last night, in his speech the Sunday before he was assassinated at March 31st, 1968, and put these in 2012. Imagine hearing these words in 2012 and what we would think of it, with King saying, "It's our experience that the nation doesn't move around questions of genuine equality for the poor or for black people until it is confronted massively, dramatically, in terms of direct action." Whew,
right.
That's quite
right.
A sentence.
Right, it is, and that's the King. That's the national memory that's not articulated.
Right. Right,
because our idea of King is 1963.
Mm-hmm.
It's the famous "I Have a Dream" speech. The idea that we all should live in brotherhood, which is a very important idea and concept. But what it takes to get there is in 1968, when he is planning for a poor people's movement.
Mm-hmm.
There's a detour. You know, he goes to Memphis. He really doesn't want to go. He goes to Memphis to support striking garbage workers. Oh, I'm sorry, his lieutenants don't want him to go because they think he should be more focused on mobilizing for the March on Washington. But he was assisting poor garbage workers in Memphis. And so this is a part of the legacy, and the idea here is that you can never let up pressure when it comes to issues related to inequality, racial inequality, no matter who's in the White House. Because you know when he was saying that in 1968, when Johnson was sitting in the White House. Johnson,
wow,
who, in my view, domestically, was the most progressive post-war president that we ever had. But even given the successes of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, King still saw the need to pressure this country around issues regarding poor people and the disenfranchised. And so the question is, as I say, we see Obama being handed the torch by King, in many ways, as a part of the legacy of King and the Civil Rights Movement. But I venture to say that, at least in the position he stands, he's on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to be pressured just like any other president around these issues.
Isn't it, though, absolutely amazing that history wasn't that long ago, Frederick Harris? Who in the world is even mentioning poor people these days? And you've got to know, with this economy and unemployment rate, there are lots of people who are really hurting. We hear the middle class. We hear, you know, who all that the rich have. But I can't recall a politician since Johnson who has really championed this issue. It's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's really sad. It's a travesty to the memory of the Civil Rights Movement and all those people who fought in the labor movement, in the civil rights movement, and other movements that really address economic inequality in this country. And so, again, it's safe to remember King in 63, but to remember him in 1968 is to really tap into that legacy. We barely hear the middle class. I mean, because there we have a discussion about, you know, with, you know, Republican candidate, you know, I'm not ashamed because I'm wealthy and I have a lot of money, but you do see the president talking about the middle class. No one's talking about the working class, the working poor people. They're not even on the political agenda.
I know.
And again, I think that vision, part of the problem is that those who are most affected, who are in that situation or who are sympathetic have not organized around these issues in effective loud voice. But also there's partly disadvantage because money is so much a part of the political process these days,
mm-hmm.
that part of getting your issue on the agenda is having the money, the resources to do it. And as we know, poor people don't have money.
Yeah. Frederick Harris, our guest. The book is The Price of the Ticket, Barack Obama and the Rise and Decline of Black Politics, 800-486-8655, the number. Leave your comments worthy of air mention on Facebook if you'd like, so we can read them, even when the show is over, at the Kathleen Dunn Show, or our email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Greg in Madison. Hi.
Thanks, Kathleen. I want to focus the discussion on what I think is the actual problem, but first I just want to take the guest to task a bit. In that Take the Bullet Out speech, Obama mentioned high incarceration rates, people going to ERs with treatable illnesses, children without health care, public schools that are bad, and Iraq. Well, he got us out of Iraq. He gave us health care. That deals with the ERs and the children. Wisconsin just received a waiver for No Child Left Behind so that, like, Milwaukee Public Schools won't automatically fail in a couple years. And so that just leaves a high rate of incarceration. That's 4 out of 5. Okay, Obama's a skilled politician. He might be – I'm like the liberal white person who's trying to defend him, but I'm also the poor white person who also benefits from health care. So I think you should go with the route of coalitions and being a skilled politician – but also deal with the real problem, which is the high rate of incarceration and the very low access to opportunity among the black population, for example, Milwaukee. What can we do about that?
Well, my response to that is that it's not an either-or proposition. The universalist approach, particularly around public health or Obamacare, is clearly a win-win for black communities and poor communities in this country, mostly because a fifth of African Americans are uninsured. So, as I say in the book, it's going to have long-term benefits to the black community. But there are also, within the coalition perspective, issues like criminal justice that aren't being addressed. And in fact, if we switch from that speech at Hampton University to the Howard University speech months later, the president lays out a clear, bold plan for criminal justice reform, perhaps the most assertive, a bold plan that I've seen from any presidential candidate. What did he say he would do? He said that if he became president, that he would support a federal-level racial profiling act, one. Two, he also promised that he could give loan forgiveness to law students who became public defenders. Why? Because he wanted to increase the number of qualified public defenders in the system, because that's clearly a disadvantage to people who don't have the resources to hire an attorney. He also promised that he was going to encourage states to place a moratorium on the death penalty. Now, I didn't put these words into his mouth. This is not sort of my imagination of what I hope the president to do. This is what the presidential candidate, Barack Obama, said when he needed the black vote. Now, I don't think the president was pandering. At least I hope not. I just don't think that he has had the courage enough in this environment to do it. And one reason why he hasn't had the encouragement is because people of goodwill who are interested in these questions haven't pressured him to do it.
Hmm. What about his point that he really made good on 4 out of 5 of the issues that he brought up in that speech that we listened to? What about Iraq?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's he's done that. But you know, my issue is around issues around racial inequality. I mean, he gave multiple speeches about things, but I'm really concentrating on those things that deal with issues that more directly impact black communities. And also, I have to say, even around criminal justice, he has narrowed but not eliminated the crack cocaine disparity. Mm-hmm. It was 100 to 1, now it's to 18 to 1. But in that speech at Hampton, he said at Howard University, he says the only difference between crack and cocaine users mostly, and the reason why they're sentencing disparities, is because of the color of the skin of most of the users.
Yeah. Greg, thank you so much for your call. Victor in Milwaukee. Hello, Victor.
Good morning. Good morning to your guest. What is President Obama's relationship with the Black Congressional Congress? Now, I bring this up for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the congressmen, obviously, are the principal lawmakers. The president is just the advocate of domestic legislation. He can only go so far. You know, when you're talking about civil rights legislation and health care and everything, it all starts with the Congress. Now, I know, realistically, he can't do no more than what he can with the Congress because they've shown themselves to be obstructionists. But what is his relationship with the Black Congressional Congress? And you have to ask yourself, why aren't they doing more to push, to advocate for some of the civil rights legislation and all of the above?
Very good question. In the first 2 years when the Democratic Party was in control, there were members of the Black Caucus who were pushing on some of these issues. We have to remember, yes, it's coming from the Congress, but the president, a Democratic president, is at the top of the party. And so the question is, how does he use the bully pulpit to push some of these issues? So, for instance, is it Congressman Ellison out of...
Yes, I believe so. Yes, out of Minnesota.
Out of Minnesota, mm-hmm. Yeah. Was pushing a bill, a jobs bill, which the president never pushed, because there was pushback from members of Democrats within the party, as well as some folks in the White House. He pushed for this idea of targeted universalism. That is that publicly financed jobs should be concentrated in areas of high unemployment and high poverty levels. The legislation never got through. The president never publicly advocated for it. A jobs bill never materialized. So it's just not Congress. Yes, you have to get Congress, but you also you can use the bully pulpit, as the president has on other issues, particularly around gay and lesbian, right? You know, he's, you know, spoken personally about his views on gay marriage. You know, he's talked about the importance of the DREAM Act, even though he couldn't get anything out during the lame duck congressional session. Members of Congress still pushed it, and he still advocated for it. And then in the end, he used his executive orders in order to stop deportations of young people who are undocumented in this country. So there is a combination of executive and also congressional actions that can be done. And there are things the president can do and advocate for despite limitations that are put on by Congress.
Hmm. Do you think it was risky for him to address LGBT issues, gay marriage, et cetera?
I don't know. I don't know if it was risky, but it sure didn't give him much political capital, because there's a slight majority in the country who are supportive of gay marriage, and there was much more of a consensus around don't ask, don't tell, but around issues of gay, you know, gay marriage. No, the country is pretty much still divided. We see what's happening in states. And also, it doesn't seem to be an electoral benefit, because if gay and lesbian voters have the most maximized influence, it's in states like New York and California, which are reliably blue states. So in many ways, the president went out on the limb on this issue. And the reason why he did this is because gay and lesbian activists kept nudging, kept pushing the president on these issues.
The pressure was on. Interesting.
Right.
Pressure was on. Very interesting. Oh, all right. Quickly, we'll get at least a comment. We're almost out of time. Claire in Germantown. Hi.
Hi.
Got to say it quickly, Claire.
Oh, what?
Can you say it quickly? We're almost out of time.
Oh, what do you think of Star Parker?
Star Parker.
Oh, that's the. Is this the conservative African-American woman?
I don't know who she is.
Yeah, I think she is. She's a whippersnapper, and you know, she's a good advocate for the cause on that side of the aisle. But you know, I don't know what to say beyond that.
Okay, well, that's it. Your book is absolutely fascinating, as the discussion has been. Frederick, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Frederick Harris, the book is The Price of the Ticket, Barack Obama and the Rise and Decline of Black Politics. He is a professor of political science and director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for your calls and for listening. For your interest and your knowledge. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you again tomorrow morning at 9 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.